Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From the Performing Arts Center at Adelphi University in Garden City, welcome to the United States of Anxiety, WNYC's pre-debate check-in on Long Island. The eyes of the world will be on Long Island next week for the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. That'll be at Hofstra University just down the road. So we thought we'd check in with Long Islanders to find out what voters are concerned about in this most classic of American suburbs. Good evening, everyone. I'm Brian Lehrer. There's an old political adage, as go the suburbs, so goes the election. Well, we all know Long Island is not going to swing this race for either candidate, not in the middle of a deep blue Democratic state like New York, but similar suburbs like those outside of Philadelphia and in Florida and Ohio will play a decisive role. So there's a good chance that the issues that resonate here will be at the top of voters' minds when they step into that booth to cast their ballots on November 8th or send them in any time now in the early voting states. We've got some great conversations in store for you tonight, and I'd like the audience here at Adelphi to know that we want you to be part of this conversation as well. After the radio broadcast portion of our program concludes at 8 o'clock, we're going to bring all of the guests back on stage and open the floor up for your questions, so please do stick around. Before we bring on our first guests, let's take the temperature in this room just a little bit. How many people plan on voting, if you're willing to say, for Hillary Clinton? People are laughing because they think there are a lot of hands up, but how many people plan on voting for Donald Trump? Oh, now people are laughing because there are almost no hands up. Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, and how many of you plan on voting for Trump but didn't want to admit it publicly the first time? Blue New York. You know, suburban Long Island has this reputation as a bastion of New York's Republican Party. This is, after all, the place that gave us Al D'Amato, Rick Lazio, the state Senate leaders, Dean Skelos, I know we don't talk about him anymore, and John Flanagan in power now, with the power that they've used many times to block any of Governor Cuomo's bills or Mayor de Blasio's requests from the city to Albany. They do that on behalf of Republican constituents on Long Island. There's also Congressman Peter King. But things are changing on Long Island. In fact, neither Nassau nor Suffolk County have cast their ballot for a Republican presidential candidate since Suffolk went for George H.W. Bush back in 1992. Once a largely white suburban enclave, Nassau and Suffolk counties are getting more diverse. About one-third of Long Island's population is now non-white, and suburban Long Island's white population has shrunk by about 5 percentage points since 2000, and that white population who is here is getting older. But Long Island's population is continuing to grow, albeit slowly. So who's taking the place of this aging, shrinking white population? Well, let's look at the census numbers. Asian Americans' share of Nassau County's population has doubled from 5 to just under 10% since 2000. Suffolk County has seen its Hispanic population grow from 11% to 19% over the same period, and more immigrants are calling suburban Long Island home. Just under 20% of Long Island's population is now made up of immigrants. So this, you might say, is not your father's Long Island. But that whole idea that Long Island is trending Democratic, at least in presidential election years, may be disrupted this year. Donald Trump is showing true signs of strength in Suffolk County in particular. He posted his second best margin in the New York State primary there, gaining 73% of the Republican votes cast in Suffolk and drawing big-time crowds to the two rallies he held on Long Island in the spring, which were both in Suffolk. One prominent pollster told my producer off the record that Suffolk is feeling Trumpy and grumpy and that it's anyone's race there in November. And that's interesting because Suffolk County does not fit the demographic profile that we tend to associate with the voters who are supporting the Trump campaign. The Trump coalition is supposed to be made up of working class, economically frustrated whites without college degrees. But Suffolk County is among the wealthiest counties in the country. Its population is largely highly educated, and it has an unemployment rate that's below the national average. But as you know, the averages don't tell the whole story. Unlike its wealthier neighbor to the west, Suffolk County has a lot more white working class communities, Babylon, Riverhead, Lindenhurst, others. Still, the people of Suffolk County, on paper at least, are economically better off than a lot of other areas of the country. So if Donald Trump's campaign is a repudiation of the entire political establishment by Americans who feel the system isn't working for them, then what can possibly account for Trump's popularity in a place like Suffolk? Well, in an attempt to find out, WNYC journalists have been spending more time than usual here on the island to talk to voters, to discover what you're anxious about in this election year, and in particular, how that anxiety has translated into support for Donald Trump. We're going to try to find out in a new election podcast miniseries from WNYC and The Nation magazine. It's called The United States of Anxiety, and it launches this Thursday, and it leads me to my first guests. Kai Wright is the show's host and executive producer and features editor at The Nation magazine. Some of you listeners might remember him as the host of There Goes the Neighborhood, WNYC's previous collaboration with The Nation about gentrification in the city. And Arun Venugopal is a reporter on the project. Some of you may know him from his regular Micropolis segments on WNYC. He's been here on Long Island spending a lot of time with Trump supporters recently. Hi, Kai. Hi, Arun.
Hello, Brian, and Hello, Adelpha.
So, Kai, talk to everybody about the project. What made you want to set an election podcast on Long Island?
Well, a lot of what you just said, Brian. I mean, the thing is that there's two things. One, we have to talk about why make a podcast specifically about Trump supporters. I think we are in an era, certainly amongst those on the left, and I think in much of the mainstream media as well, where it is very easy to dismiss and caricature what millions of Americans are feeling around Donald Trump as simply racist and crazy. And, Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables comment set to the side, she got herself in trouble, but I'll repeat it. There is no question that there is a significant portion of Donald Trump supporters who are avowed white supremacists. There are a significant portion of Donald Trump supporters, however, who are not, and who we are trying to find out where they are coming from, because whatever is motivating this segment of America, it is not going to disappear on November 9th. And so as a nation, we have to wrestle with that. And we felt like Long Island and Suffolk County in particular was a fertile place to wrestle with this because it is a place where, as we'll talk about tonight, politics are still up for debate. And in a deeply blue state, we are nonetheless in a place where Donald Trump could very well win. It's feeling Trumpy and grumpy. And that's in part we're hearing because of all of the trends that mirror things that are happening in the United States, particularly the changing demographics, fights over development and economic development, where should money go, the changing nature of work. All of these things are playing out in acute ways in the suburbs of Long Island, so it's a fertile place to go and hear from folks about how they're dealing with those things.
So, Arun, you've been here on the island spending time with Trump supporters. Can you begin to discern patterns? Where would you start?
Well, I think the people that I've met here and have been spending a lot of time with, you get the sense that they feel like this is not the Long Island that they moved to, say, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years ago. The people I've been spending a lot of time with, they came in the post-war era in the 50s or the 60s. They might have moved here from Brooklyn or Queens. There was sort of a utopian quality to Long Island back then. It was a very exciting time. The suburbs were booming, and there was a very exciting promise to that. And that's not the way they feel now. One of the people I've been spending a lot of time with, her name is Patty Dwyer. She's 60. She's this very fun-loving, vibrant person. She's a respiratory therapist. She moved here when she was about two. Her family moved here when she was very small from New York City. And I think when you hear the frustrations that she has, she was an Obama supporter. She voted for Obama in 2008. But since then, she's kind of done a 180-degree sort of turn. And we can listen to her right here. There is a sense that I think this isn't just about race. This is really about class as well. There's some sort of a sense of betrayal by the establishment. So we can listen to Patty right here.
I was happy and looking forward to the first black president that he's black and white. And it's awesome. He could have used that for, oh my God, to bring us all together and such. Instead, it's snarky comments about Christians and the Crusades and another division about the police, another division. Even with the Orlando thing, coming out and being snarky about radical Islam. I'm not talking about Islam, radical Islam. Being snarky about it, there's nothing funny about this. A lot of us feel that he's laughing. He's laughing and he's mocking anyone who feels that way.
So, Brian, I think it's that last part she said that really struck a nerve, I think, really hit home for me. What you're talking about here is sort of the sense that you have the elites and then you have us, and we're not being taken seriously anymore.
Kai, it's not just Trump supporters that your project is examining. I know you're also spending a good chunk of time looking at Long Island's rapidly growing immigrant population as well. What interested you in their story in this context?
Yeah, I mean, so we've called the podcast United States of Anxiety, and part of it is that, you know, we're acknowledging that across a broad swath of this country, people are struggling. And they're struggling for a host of reasons. Things, as Arun put it, are not as they once were. They don't have the safety and the security that they once were. They at least perceive that to be the case. And I think one of the ironies is that while you have some of the folks that Arun's been talking to who are wrestling with what loss they're feeling over the last 8 years, 8+ years, some of them, as we talked about, some of them have real loss. Some of them are doing well financially, actually. When you look at immigrant communities who have been quite a part of this election, right? I mean, it's very clear that part of a core part of Donald Trump's message is that part of your problem, if you're feeling loss in America, is because you've been sold out to undocumented immigrants. And when you talk to immigrant communities, they have very real reasons to have anxiety. In the past 8 years, we've deported more people than ever in the history of the United States in the course of the Obama administration. And so we have interviewed people who are living with that, who are living with that anxiety. We'll play a clip of one woman. We're calling her Lenny. That is not her real name. Her fiance is facing deportation, and she describes what has happened in her life over the recent past with as her fiance gets deported. She's talking to one of our reporters, Julianne Hing.
He was working 7 to 7, and he working a lot. That's why, you know, he made good money and he supported myself. But, you know, bro, he's that kind of person. He love go to the bed and everybody jump on him.
It felt like the American dream was in Lenny's grasp.
So after 13 years, when nothing happens, you get confident. And one day, boom, your dream go down.
So she's talking about when her fiancé was arrested. And he was being deported on a 13-year-old drug crime. He could have been deported 13 years ago, but we didn't deport people for those kinds of things 13 years ago. And so this is the new reality she's facing.
Now, Arun, your reporting is often focused on race, culture, and identity. So how are you applying that lens when you're essentially reporting on white people who themselves have a very different view of race and identity than other groups?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is the last few years you've seen in the popular discourse so much more attention being paid to people of color, historically sort of marginalized communities, and that's been exciting to be sort of part of that, reporting those stories. At the same time, I think that I always felt like the larger story of racial discourse and racial relations has sort of been sidelining, I think, a lot of white people. And certainly you see that, you hear that sentiment expressed by people like Patty, who you just heard, the sense that their story is given short shrift, that they feel like anything they say is challenged or seen as, you know, subtly racist, those kinds of things. So I do feel like it's very important to be giving... there's a tension here, you know, with politics and with media as well. How do you give attention to, say, communities of color? Can you do that at the same time to give attention to communities, to white suburbanites who have genuine problems? And I think that that's really, you know, the struggle, the political struggle we're witnessing right now.
You know, and to add to that is there has been a much more robust conversation in, you know, even the past decade, if we can go that far back, about people of color and race in America. But we very rarely talk about white racial identity, both its problems and its and the things that are good about it. We don't put white people on the couch in the way that we do people of color, and that we do a disservice to everybody if we don't interrogate whiteness and we don't interrogate what's going on with white people politically.
I mean, the very term white, I grew up in an Indian American household in Houston, and we never referred to white people. Whenever we were trying to make a distinction between our ways and the ways of white people, we'd say, oh, that's how Americans do it.
Huh.
You know, that was a term that we used. And people say, what do you mean? You're not American? Yeah, we're American, but you're trying to make distinctions.
So that wasn't a skin color distinction. That was an immigrant distinction.
Yeah, huh? Exactly. It was more like, that's the mainstream. Now you hear kids, everybody refers to, oh, that's so white. It's become the shorthand. It's become a pejorative often. It's sort of sometimes joking, but sometimes it's more charged. I think that's felt by people like Trump supporters. They feel the sense that they're being put on the spot, and they're being dismissed, made fun of.
All right, Arun, thank you. We'll hear you on the podcast. Kai's going to stay on and talk to some of the other guests with me. You're listening to the United States of Anxiety, a pre-debate check-in on Long Island from the Adelphi University Performing Arts Center, live on WNYC and WSHU. We'll be right back.
And you are listening to a live public forum from Adelphi University on Long Island. It's part of our weekly election series, The United States of Anxiety. Here it's starting this Thursday at 7 on 93.9 FM, WNYC. Tonight, foggy with lows around 69, currently 70 degrees and overcast in Central Park.
WNYC receives support from Zoom. Zoom offers cloud video conferencing, online meetings, group messaging, and a video conference room solution in one platform featuring digital video and audio with screen sharing, account registration, and more at zoom.us. WNYC is a media partner of the PBS documentary series POV. Tonight at 10 on 13, Kingdom of Shadows looks at the hard choices in the U.S.-Mexico drug war. Details at pov.org.
93.9 FM, WNYC, NPR News and the New York Conversation.
From Adelphi University in Garden City, Long Island, this is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Brian Lehrer with my partner for the rest of the hour, Kai Wright, features editor of The Nation and host and producer of the new WNYC podcast called The United States of Anxiety. Kai and I want to bring out our next guests, and I want to spend more time examining where voters' heads are in the run-up to this election. As we continue our pre-debate check-in here on Long Island, Trump might actually win in Suffolk County in particular, which no Republican presidential candidate has done since 1988, as we mentioned earlier. Lawrence Levy is the executive director of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University, known to Adelphians as Brand X. And John J. Lavelle is the chairman of the Suffolk County Republican Committee. If you consume a lot of TV news, you've probably seen him on cable. He's also an official spokesman for the Trump campaign. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
And Larry, for those of you who don't know, is like the ultimate expert on Long Island politics and political culture. So, Larry, how different are Nassau and Suffolk in these basic respects?
Well, overall, they're quite different. Suffolk is, I heard on the earlier segment that it was one of the richest places in the country, and it's probably true, but relative to what it costs to live here, it's not so rich. You can earn $100,000 a year on Long Island and barely be in the middle class. But Suffolk, demographically, based on census data, is poorer, has a slightly higher unemployment rate, the houses are worth less, the level of education is a little bit lower. It has pockets of enormous wealth, the Hamptons, some places along the Gold Coast, but it has broad, broad territory, very much like the kinds of places where Donald Trump has done well, working class whites who, even if you looked at a $110,000 a year household income, may have found themselves earning a lot less than they were, certainly a lot less than their parents were 20, 30 years ago.
John, you were a relatively early backer of the Trump campaign, I see. Yes. You endorsed him in the early spring ahead of the New York primary. And the two Republican congressmen that served Long Island, Peter King and Lee Zeldin, followed shortly thereafter. So I'm assuming that's because they see, unlike a lot of other Republican members of Congress around the country, little electoral disadvantage in backing Trump. So what's Trump's appeal in a place like Suffolk County?
Well, Suffolk County is a very unique place, and it's very diverse, but it's a working-class community. And we have, for instance, in the 1st Congressional District, it's probably has one of the largest percentages of veterans in the entire United States of America. But Donald Trump's appeal, for instance, to law enforcement, to police officers, firefighters, EMS workers, trade union workers, are very appealing. They like Donald Trump. So we are a working class community. Although many people know us for the Hamptons, we are not necessarily the Hamptons. And you know, what a lot of people don't realize, Suffolk County, Nassau County, for instance, Suffolk County is larger than 10 states. Nassau County is also larger than 10 states. So either county would be the 41st state in the union. Together, we'd be 30-something. So this is a very unique place, but we're very concerned about the economy and about our security. Those issues poll very high again and again and again. And being a community that is just outside of New York City, having been directly affected by 9/11, security issues are important. Look at the two congressmen that we just discussed. Peter King is an expert in homeland security. Lee Zeldin fought in the war, Iraqi war. He is on the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Veterans Affairs Committee. So we are very security-minded people, but we're also concerned about our jobs. And although we are a wealthy community, like Larry said, a lot of people are one paycheck away from, you know, going under. So we are concerned. We need better paying jobs and better jobs.
Okay. John, let me ask you about this security question, actually both of you, is because a number of people we've spoken to who are Trump supporters, Patty, who we played earlier was one of them, were Obama voters in 2008. And they liked Obama's strength, is what they say. And one of the biggest things they talk about with Donald Trump is his strength and this security thing. It's a better question for Larry. How can someone be behind both Obama and Donald Trump on the question of strength?
I haven't seen the data or the polling that
this is purely anecdotal.
Okay, I would say it's probably very anecdotal. I think there is a sliver, absolutely a sliver of Obama supporters who are voting for Trump. I don't think it's a very large number. Right now, and I think, John, I'd be interested in what the Suffolk polling is, if you're allowed to talk about it. But I think that 90% of Democrats are voting for Clinton and about 82% of Republicans are voting for Trump. So there's not a lot of...
More trying to get to this idea of strength, regardless if there's
right.
one of them or five of them or a million of them.
Right.
What is it... What? And so then for John, what is it... If you know Trump supporters who voted for Obama based on this strength idea. What is it? Unpack that for us. What are we talking about?
I'm not sure that's why they may have voted for him. Long Islanders, you know, the message, for instance, with Bill Clinton was hope. With President Obama, hope and change. With Donald Trump, it is also that hope. He's talking about bringing jobs back to America, putting Americans back to work. In fact, 14 million more people are out of work today than they were 7 years ago. 7 million more people in America are considered to be poverty-stricken than they were 7 years ago. Americans want change. They want that hope. They see these trade deals that have affected us. For instance, on Long Island, we don't manufacture anything anymore. So a lot of those middle-class or working-class jobs are gone. So we're recreating our economy. Companies like Grumman are gone, you know, that were manufacturing defense parts. So we're recreating ourselves here on Long Island. But we get that message of the need to bring jobs back to America, the need to make America first and worry about the priorities of Americans before we worry about the priorities of others. And I think that is his message. It's strong, and it's been very compelling to Long Islanders. So it's less about strength. Security is important, but it's about jobs, it's about our economy, and it's about getting back to work.
John,
without taking some
Larry,
time,
go ahead.
Finish, put a period on that sentence. I would suspect that some of this difference in perceptions of strength are gender-based. If Hillary Clinton was a guy, I don't know that, you know, someone who pulled the trigger on bin Laden and, you know, was in the room with a lot of other decisions would be seen as weaker if she were a he.
And maybe also race-based.
I didn't go for an applause line.
Gender gets Larry Levy from Hofstra Center for Suburban Studies applause at Adelphi tonight.
Applause-averse.
John J. Lavelle, spokesman for the Trump campaign and Suffolk County Republican chair. One view is that anyone who supports Trump has to have a high tolerance for bigotry, considering the things he has said about so many groups, from, forgive me, I'll do this fast, Mexican-Americans to Seventh-day Adventists to Muslims through the Kaiser Khan family, POWs, disabled people, women bleeding from wherever, pretending not to know who David Duke was when he had denounced him before running for president.
I get your point.
The whole birther thing.
Basket of deplorables?
Yes.
These are just the things that, you know, Trump said that have made a lot of news. Does the white population of Suffolk County, do you as an individual have that much tolerance for bigotry?
No, Donald Trump is not a bigot. Donald Trump is not a racist. Donald Trump is not a sexist. Those are facts. What Donald Trump's concerned about.
And that one's a laugh line at Adelphi.
John, you're on a college campus.
I understand I'm on a college campus. But let me tell you, we have a problem with immigration in our community. And Larry will tell you, Larry used to cover me when I was the supervisor of Brookhaven Town. We were dealing with immigration issues back then. And what I find to be upsetting is that when I left public office December 31 of 2005, when I was a councilman in 96, we were talking about immigration. The problem is both parties have been talking about the issue. Neither party has offered solutions. The reality is we need to secure our borders in this country. We need to know who is in our country.
Is that
important?
Is it important
to
you?
So it doesn't make you a racist. Let me say this. Because you're saying we have an immigration problem, which we do, does not make you a racist. Because you're saying that there are drugs coming up through the Mexican border, which is true, these are facts that we have to deal with in America. I will say this. Regardless of what happens in this election, Donald Trump's candidacy for president is the single most important candidacy in modern American history. He is making the politicians speak about issues that they don't want to speak about. He's talking about the things that make all of them cringe, and he's forcing a debate. Regardless of what side you fall on in the debate, he is forcing this debate. I think this has been an incredible election cycle.
You know, there are many ways that I could follow up on that I'm not going to in this forum. But let me just ask you to localize it. Mm-hmm. Do you think illegal immigration is such a big problem in Suffolk County that this has to be the priority of the next president?
No, in Suffolk County, one of our greatest economic engines has been tourism, especially in eastern Suffolk County through the Hamptons and Montauk. And we understand that immigrants are a very important part of our population. So it is not an issue that is driving. What I believe the issue that's driving Suffolk County residents to support Donald Trump is the economy and security. It's not immigration. Immigrants are a very important part of our society, our hotel, restaurant industry.
Certainly in the folks we're talking to, John, is it appears impossible to de-link for them security and immigration, and the economy and immigration. Whether or not those links are substantively true, we can debate, but for the voters we're talking to, immigration is itself the greatest security threat.
No, it's the type of immigration. We want to secure our borders. We want to know who's here. Over the last few days, we're dealing with additional, terrorism issues. There's international terrorism. There's domestic terrorism. We as Long Islanders, we want to know that we're safe. We want to know that our family's safe. I don't think that's a political issue. I don't care what side of the aisle you are on. Both candidates are talking about trying to make America safer. They have different views on how to achieve that, but they're both talking about that. So the security issues for some of the immigration issues that we've experienced here on Long Island, it's more about, housing issues and general community issues. The issues on some of the, terrorism that's coming from the Middle East into our country, those are issues that are more of our national security type of issues. So there's different angles of the immigration issue that people are looking at.
And Larry Levy, for you as a political analyst of Long Island, how do you see the immigration playing a role
presidential support? I think Kai's absolutely right. I think it's linked in a whole basket of things, including job security and personal security. Whether that's fair, whether it holds up to factual scrutiny, but I think that is probably a fair analysis. And immigrants are a huge driver of the Long Island economy, and it's not just the stereotypical person working in the diner back room washing dishes or cutting lawns. We're talking about people who are discovering the next wave of cancer care at Cold Spring Harbor, and it's a very, very important part of the new economy, not just the old service economy.
And it's as we've discussed, there is no question. I mean, Long Island has been home to some of the most heated and consequential debates over immigration in the country since 9/11. And we have seen not only political debates but real violence over this topic. And it's a place where, as I've said, where the demographic change that is true across America has been has shown up strong and clear, and it seems to me in talking to voters here that folks are having a hard time making sense of that.
I want to thank Lawrence Levy, Executive Director of the National Center for Suburban Studies at Hofstra University. He puts out such great material. Thank you very much. And John J. Lavelle, Chairman of the Suffolk County Republican Committee and an official spokesman for the Donald Trump campaign. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And if you're just joining us on WNYC in New York and WSHU in Fairfield, from Adelphi University in Garden City, Long Island, this is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Brian Lehrer with my partner, Kai Wright, from The Nation magazine and from the new WNYC podcast called The United States of Anxiety. Both of our next guests have taken their individual loss of loved ones and turn them into second careers as advocates in attempts to better their community here on Long Island. Josela Lucero is the brother of Marcela Lucero, who was killed in an anti-immigrant hate crime in Patchogue in 2008. He's now an immigrant advocate and works as an outreach coordinator for the Hagedorn Foundation. Dorothy Johnson lost her only child, Maxwell, to a heroin overdose in 2011. She's the founder and president of Maxed Out Drug Prevention. My thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Hosello, I don't have to tell you that your brother Marcelo's murder made national headlines, but for listeners who might be unfamiliar with the case, can you briefly recount what happened to him and why he was attacked that night?
First of all, thank you, everybody, to be here today and to allow me to have this opportunity to talk about this. You know, my brother, Marcelo Lucero, he's from Ecuador, South America, and he came to the United States in 1994. You know, he was in the United States for at least 16 years. You know, after this, my brother was walking in the streets of Pacho, going to one of his friends, got to visit him in November 8, 2008, and he was attacked for 7 teenagers. And they surrounded him, and one of them stabbed him, and, you know, he bled in the street. And they taken half an hour, more than half an hour, to take it 2 miles away from the place of the scene, and my brother died.
Even now, 8 years later, it's hard to even hear it, and I'm sure it's hard to talk about it. Thank you for your courage in that respect. And the teens who attacked your brother said they were going, quote, beaner hopping. That is, they were looking to jump Hispanic immigrants. And that apparently was not an unusual occurrence in that part of Long Island, if not always with those tragic results. Why do you think anti-immigrant sentiment was so pervasive in parts of suburban Long Island, particularly Suffolk County, at that time?
You know, Suffolk County has so much history against immigrants. You know, they started with the Mexican community. First of all, I don't know why they have so much anger to the people from Mexico. You know, it's hardworking people. And the stereotype about every immigrant that came from any country, they believe we are undocumented and we don't pay taxes, we steal the jobs, which is not true. You know, my brother is from Ecuador, South America, and there's nothing to do. My brother and I, we went to high school and college. I studied mechanical industrial, and because I cannot speak English when I just came to this country, you know, I had to start from the bottom. Same as my brother. But my brother, because he just looked like the rest of all, Hispanic, he was attacked for no reason. You know, at 36 years old, my older brother, he was my friend, he was my father, he was everything for me, and he was taken away for no reason. 7 teenagers that commit this crime, they attack at least once a week for over a year, Hispanic.
We'll get back to you in a second, Hosello. Dorothy Johnson, tell us a little bit about Max, if you can. What was he like growing up, and how did his addiction start, most relevant to what we're talking about here, and at what age?
Well, my son Maxwell is my only child. He was born in New York City. We lived in Manhattan. When he was 14 years old, we moved out to Long Island. Who would ever thought that heroin would be his death? But
did you move here in part to get away from what you
thought? No, actually, my first husband unfortunately passed away, and I met someone at my 20th high school reunion, and I got married 6 months later, and my husband now is a commercial fisherman, and he lives on Long Island, so I had to come back to Long Island. And I thought, you know, the schools were great. He graduated, he went to tech school. Unfortunately, he was in a very bad car accident, and he had 6 surgeries on his feet. He almost lost both his legs, and he was on pain medication. It was not overprescribed, but at one point he came to me and said, "Ma, I think I'm just taking too much. I think I need some help." So he did reach out to me, and we sent him to a rehab. And he came back from the rehab and he said, "Ma, I learned more about drugs than I ever knew." And I thought he was educated from this. He seemed to be doing very well. A few months later, he comes home. He was at a party in Blue Point, where I live. And he said, "Ma, I need to talk to you." He said, "I was at this party and some girl was getting high and she stuck a needle in my arm. And I said, Max, cut it out. He's 6'4", 185 pounds. I said, don't kid around with me like that. He said, no, Ma, it's true. And he broke down. I said, how could you have let this happen? He said, Ma, I don't know. I'm scared. How could I have let this happen? I'm a registered nurse. And as a registered nurse, I didn't really know enough about it because it wasn't talked about. Well, it was 6 months later. Max walks in the house and says, Ma, I need to talk to you. I stuck the needle in my arm. And that was the beginning of the end. He went to so many rehabs, and nothing worked. There was nothing that really worked for him. Sitting in a rehab and getting lectured day in and day out does not do the soul any good. They need more. The rehabs need to change. The way that they treat the individual needs to change. First of all, trying to get a child into a rehab is a major problem. And today, it's even worse. When I went back to work thinking that it would be really good for me to get the support that I needed working in the medical profession, I went back to work and nobody would talk about it. Nobody would talk about my son because he died from heroin. Heroin was a dirty word. I said, I need to do something about this. So I started a nonprofit, and I said, I'm going to speak about it. I planted a tree on the grounds of St. Ursula Center in Blue Point, and I said, as this tree grows, so will increased awareness.
Kai, you have a question?
So we asked both of you guys to join us because a lot of what is coming up when we talk to folks in immigrant communities, Trump supporters, and people just throughout Long Island is loss and the feeling of loss, and both of you have had the most extreme and profound examples of that in your lives. The heroin epidemic is the course of a lot of loss in specifically white Long Island, and both violence and deportation have been the source of loss in immigrant communities. I'm just curious from both of you to talk about how does, in your community and the people around you, your friends and your circles, how widespread is this feeling of loss in the worlds in which you're moving around? Just each of you, I'd like to hear you talk about that.
And you know what? We're up against a break. So let me take that break so you can give your answers with some fullness right afterwards. You're listening to the United States of Anxiety, a pre-debate check-in on Long Island from the Adelphi University Performing Arts Center, live on WNYC and WSHU, and we will be right back.
You are listening to a live public forum from Adelphi University on Long Island. It's part of our weekly education series, our weekly election series, rather, the United States of Anxiety. And you can sign up for the podcast now at wnyc.org/anxiety.
WNYC is supported by GEICO, offering auto insurance coverage for cars, trucks, or SUVs, and providing 24/7 customer service. More information on auto insurance at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
Millions of people will risk everything to be an American, and it doesn't always end well.
He got arrested. I was like, how come? I say, it's over. You're going to get deported.
The United States of Anxiety, an election series from WNYC and The Nation magazine that gives voice to the emotions driving this presidential campaign. Tune in Thursday nights at 7 on WNYC 93.9 FM or listen at wnyc.org/anxiety.
From Adelphi University in Garden City, Long Island, this is the United States of Anxiety. I'm Brian Lehrer with my partner, Kai Wright, from The Nation magazine and from the new WNYC podcast called The United States of Anxiety. And for just another couple of minutes with Josello Lucero, brother of Marcelo Lucero, who was killed in an anti-immigrant hate crime in Patchogue in 2008, and Dorothy Johnson, who lost her only child, Maxwell, to a heroin overdose in 2011 and became the founder and president of Maxed Out Drug Prevention. And the answer, the question, I guess, was about the political context of loss. Dorothy?
In the cultural context of it, with just how much it's, how present is loss in your world and in your communities? How many people are talking about this?
Well, it's devastating. I mean, we have a pandemic on Long Island And I live in Blue Point, which is a beautiful, nice town on the South Shore. And people think that, you know, it doesn't happen in the good towns. There are no drugs here. Parents are not acknowledging the fact that our youth are doing drugs, and they're turning to heroin because it's so available. They'll go to a party, and, you know, a lot of times they'll be at a party drinking, and 95% of the time there's an illegal drug there. And most of the time it's something that's laced with heroin. If it's marijuana, that there's heroin in it. And the kids will make the wrong choice and smoke it, and it'll just, you know, just move on, and they'll do it a second time.
And Josello, briefly, same question.
Yes. You know, one of the things, media and politicians have a lot of power. When, you know, you have a kids, they listen to the radio or watch the TV, and every politician blames immigrants to come to this country and sell drugs or stealing the jobs. It's no relation with that. You know, but what happens is the kids or people being absorbed in negativity about immigrants, sometimes they want to take it to their own hands. In the case of my brother, that happens.
Josello and Dorothy, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm sure it's difficult each time you talk about these stories, but hopefully for some good. Thank you both very, very much. Thank you. Thank you. And on the United States of Anxiety, live from Adelphi University in Garden City, here are some titles of works and articles written about the presidential campaign, and specifically the base of Donald Trump. How Donald Trump exposed America's white identity crisis. Donald Trump and the twilight of white America. Strangers in their own land. These are just some recent headlines, and they just might be onto something. A poll conducted by the Atlantic Magazine and the Aspen Institute last year found that black and Hispanic Americans are far more optimistic about the country and its future than are whites. So what's going on? Are we at some kind of turning point in the racial history of the United States, particularly when it comes to where white Americans fall on the country's racial hierarchy? Are we witnessing the beginning of some kind of changing of the guard? To find out, we are honored to have here at Adelphi the woman who literally wrote the book on the topic. Nell Irvin Painter is professor of American history emeritus at Princeton. She's the author of the 2010 book, The History of White People. Dr. Painter, thanks so much for coming out to the island, joining us. Is something fundamentally changing in white America right now?
No.
No.
But before I say more, I want to make one thing really, really clear. My book, The History of White People, is a history book. It's an intellectual history. It's based on historical sources. It comes up almost to the present time because it came out in 2010, but it is not a polemic, and it isn't like what I'm going to tell you right now. What I'm going to tell you right now, I'm speaking as a citizen. I'm not speaking, well, okay, I'm speaking as a historian, as a citizen who's a historian. But I want to keep these two things separate, the book, which is a work of history, scholarly history.
Got it.
And
your commentary.
I've become a pundit, a Trump pundit.
It's what happens when you know something.
So tell us.
Sometimes when you don't know something. But yeah, tell us.
Yeah. Why do I say no, that this is not new? In our history, the United States history, we've had several moments in which there have been shakings up of the culture and the society. Remember, the United States was founded as a slaveholding republic in which women could not vote and non-whites could not vote. So it started deep in what we now call racism, or what we should call white supremacy, what we recognize as the battle far, far ago yesterday's. So the history, as long as our country has been our country, that is, since 1789, has been contending not only with the economics and the politics and the sectionalism and the different parts of the country geographically, but also with this tension between being a democracy and being a race-based society. So every time we've had a shaking up of that 1789 agreement about who should call the shots, there has been a backlash. So, for instance, there was the Civil War and there was Reconstruction, and then there was a terrible terrorist backlash, which we historians called redemption. When we use it in quotes, because that was the white supremacist word, the former Confederates took their region back. So that was one big backlash. There have been some other smaller ones, but one some of you may even remember, and which is going on now even, is the backlash against desegregation. And note, I don't say integration, I say desegregation, because we're not integrated yet. But even desegregation, excuse me, was enough to cause National Democrats to walk out of the Democratic Convention in 1948 and found their own states' rights, or Dixiecrat Party. Strom Thurmond ran for president. That was 48. 64, Strom Thurmond became the first well-known Southern white Democrat to become a Republican.
Okay. Let me interrupt you there, though, Nell, because I want to bring it forward to back to making you a Trump pundit.
You don't want me to walk you through.
Well, there is a history I do want you to walk us through a little bit. And in specifically thinking about your book, one of the things you pointed, yes, this we regularly have this moment of debate. But one of the things we also have a moment of debate over is what is whiteness itself and how that relates to who is a citizen and who is not. And so is there something new about this moment in that debate? Or what is the context? Put this moment in historical context.
Good question. First of all, the theme of my book about what is whiteness is things change. And so it kept changing. And it changes according to who's speaking, to whom, when, where, and for what purpose. Very often people like to think that the idea of one big white race, you're in or you're out, it's kind of a toggle switch. That is an idea that gained currency in the 1940s after the national mobilization of the New Deal and especially the Second World War. And in that idea, there's one big white race and you're either in it or you're out of it. And if you're in it, you're in it all the way. However, the prevailing views before then was certainly a big white race, but different groups of people hierarchically arranged. So my test, it wasn't that you were either in or out. It wasn't how the Irish became white. The Irish always were white. They were just an inferior kind of white. They belonged to an inferior white race called the Celtic. And the newer immigrants of the turn of the 20th century, they were racialized. They were Northern Italian, the Northern Italian race, the Southern Italian race. There were Eastern European Hebrews. There were Greeks. There were Romanians. There were Slavs. They were all considered white. The test, could adult males vote? And the answer was yes. And you see that in New York City, where lots and lots of different kinds of white men, before women could vote, they did vote, and they had the advantages of patronage jobs and also of influencing politics. So it changes.
And this this idea of new immigrants, it often changes with each group of people
right.
who are called a new immigrants, correct?
Right.
In which case, we could
my pet theory, perhaps you correct me, is that part of what we're debating in a place like Long Island and in this country, and where we have these demographic changes, mm-hmm. is whether these most recent, quote, new immigrants, where they fit
yes.
in the pecking order of race yeah. in America.
And over and over again, you speak of new immigrants. That's a term we use for the Southern and Eastern European immigrants around the turn of the 20th century. I don't hear that term so much used now, but I don't live on Long Island. The big immigrant wave before that was the Irish of the middle of the 19th century, and they were very much disdained. They were white people, but they were very much disdained. And the kinds of stereotypes that tend to go along with xenophobia, with anti-immigrants feeling, is they won't or they can't assimilate. They cannot become Americans. They pollute the public sphere by being different, by talking their languages instead of English.
So can I ask you ideas. On that point, and we've got about 2.5 minutes left, where Latinos fit in? Because mm-hmm. on the one hand, they're ethnically Hispanic, but that's their ethnicity, not their race. There are white Latinos, black Latinos.
And it's changed over the census years.
And when I asked recently the former Republican governor of New Jersey, Tom Kaine, sort of, isn't Trump a racist because of what he says about Mexicans question, he said, no, he can't be a racist for that because Latino isn't a race. So where do you see them
yes.
fitting in?
My governor always has an answer, yes.
Your present governor and your past governor.
You were speaking in census terms, but we don't live in census terms. So the census comes out every 10 years, and it's a political document for political purposes. It asks the questions we need answered in terms of public policy. So the first census to ask the two questions that you mentioned, ethnicity and race, was 2000. It turns out that in 2000, Latinos/Hispanics weren't doing right because they weren't picking their races right. They kept saying some other race.
Not white.
There is no other.
That was a category.
Choice.
It was other. Right. They were choosing other.
So, they were choosing other. They were choosing some other race. They were choosing more than one and so forth. So it got fiddled again for 2010, and I'm sure it will change again for 2020. But the idea that you have both an ethnicity and a race is one that comes out of the census. And I would be very surprised if you all go around in your normal everyday lives thinking, okay, my ethnicity is Hispanic or not Hispanic or not Hispanic black or not Hispanic some other race, but I'm white, but I'm not Hispanic, I'm non-Hispanic white. No, wait, I'm Hispanic white, but...
And now that we're all thoroughly confused, I want to thank you very much for sharing your wisdom as we are out of time. Dr. Painter, thank you for joining us again. You were on my morning show on Friday and here at Adelphi. And thanks to all our guests, and a special thanks to all of you in the audience here at Adelphi University. Give yourselves a round of applause. Just a reminder to you who are here in person to stick around. We'll be bringing all the guests back out for an audience Q&A in the room. Now, for those listening on the radio, we're going to leave you with a lot of thanks and a reminder that the new election podcast from WNYC and The Nation magazine will premiere this Thursday. It's called The United States of Anxiety. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You will find a sneak preview waiting for you there now. With Kai Wright, I'm Brian Lehrer. Thank you for listening.